Hello, my name is Pam Benigno, and I'm the director of the Education Policy Center at the Independence Institute, a free market think tank in Denver, Colorado. And today with me is my guest, Dr. David Randall. Good afternoon, Dr.
Good
Randall.
afternoon. Thank you so much for having me on.
Nice to have you here. Dr. Randall has a PhD in history. He's taught at the college level. He is the research director at the National Association of Scholars. He's the executive director of the Civics Alliance. And we're here today to talk about social studies. And some of our conversation will be specific to Colorado, but most of it will be just getting to know a new program that probably about 7 months ago. The Civics Alliance released called the American Birthright, the Civics Alliance Model Standards for K through 12 Social Studies. So, David, why don't you go ahead and start with an explanation? Give us a little foundation about the National Association of Scholars and the Civics Alliance and why you all were interested in social studies.
The National Association of Scholars was founded in 1987 to work against the politicization of higher education, to promote the search for truth in higher education, to support the preservation of Western civilization, and to support virtuous citizenship. The virtuous citizenship is how we got into K-12 civics education and social studies education. You need to have a proper civics and social studies education to be prepared to be educated for virtuous citizenship at the undergraduate level. Therefore, we started to work on the K-12 level, not least to make certain that students can be properly prepared, as I say, for citizenship at the college level. But obviously, every high school graduate ought to be prepared to be a virtuous citizen, no matter whether they go to college or not. We are a group of largely professors, although we welcome people who are interested in higher education reform. It was founded largely among professors who, as I say, were concerned about politicization, very much concerned practically about politicization towards the then progressive and now radical left, which was becoming increasingly illiberal. And restrictive, as many decades ago, and has alas only gotten worse since.
Can you explain to our audience what illiberal means?
That they illiberal, as I am using it, means not willing to allow opposing views to be expressed, argued. In the higher education context, it means not hiring professors who disagree with the consensus. It means punishing students or professors or staff who disagree with the consensus. It means abandoning institutional neutrality and announcing that the university or the department is in favor of a political position, which censors, silences anybody who might disagree with that politicized position. It includes compelled speech, which comes along with abandoning institutional neutrality, that you force people to argue for positions they don't agree with. And using all of the administrative machinery of higher education to enforce this illiberality.
Well, unfortunately, I believe we're seeing that at the K through 12 level now. So it's certainly impacting our students and as well as our teachers who would like that freedom to be who they are.
We would agree, and I will say in particular, the schools of education have unfortunately been a heart of the growing illiberalism of the academy, and the illiberal, nature of the schools of education has unfortunately had an effect on the teachers and administrators at the K-12 level.
Would you say that really started around the 1990s, or do you? have an idea on that.
One way is to say it started in the 1920s. Another way is to say that it started in the 1960s. There has been a progressive ratchet leftwards, you know, towards a liberalism where you first minimize opposing positions, then ignore them, and then stigmatize them and say that you are immoral to hold them.
Well, that is certainly going on in K-12 education, definitely. So just to give a little background to our audience about Colorado and why, one reason why I'm so interested in this, last November, that would be 2022, our state, after a year long of public comment and discussion, adopted social studies standards. Now in Colorado, we really have an advantage, I believe, because our state constitution says that the state cannot prescribe textbooks, any curricula. That is up to the local school district. So we have local control in our state. And so the state has to be very careful in setting standards, but in 1993, it passed in Colorado to have academic standards, and they added, they started with reading and math, and they've added more along the way. And social studies is one of those topics. Now, in Colorado, social studies includes many topics, geography and civics, history, economics, and recently they added financial literacy. So, and our standards also start at preschool and they go all the way up to 12th grade. And they're very, very skill oriented. So although there's, they're very skill oriented, there is some content as well, but really it's been left up to school districts to fill in, to put the meat on the bone on what's being taught in schools. And so the American Birthright standards, they look very, very different than Colorado standards. And this gives school districts, school board members the opportunity to take a look at the American Birthright standards because they're supposed to adopt their own standards. They need to take a look at the states, of course, and those are guidelines for them. And they can fill in the gaps where American Birthright standards may not cover, for instance, economics in preschool. So I'd like us to just talk a little bit more specifically about the standards now. We have some, I know we will have some school board members interested in this discussion. We have had one school district in Colorado so far just recently adopt the American Birthright Social Studies standards, and that's Woodland Park. And I believe there'll be some others interested as well once they get to know the standards a little bit and see the benefits of bringing in more information and more content, which our state certainly allows. It's not curriculum, though, and you can talk a little bit about that as well, but it's certainly more detail than our state standards. For instance, I taught fifth grade. I taught fifth grade history, and so I took a look in Colorado's content standards, and nowhere in there does it mention for students to know what the names of the 13 colonies were. All right. Again, Colorado standards are very broad, but American Birthright includes knowing, in fact, I'm going to read this. On a map of North America, identify the first 13 colonies and describe how regional differences in climate, types of farming, populations, religious affiliations, and sources of labor shaped their economies and societies through the 18th century. Now, through that one standard, teachers can hit on history, they can hit on geography, and they can also discuss economics. And that's the way these standards are set up. The social studies standards topics are woven in throughout all of the Civics Alliance standards. So teachers can cover those various areas. So why don't you give us a little more detail about what you all have done?
Well, thank you. What we did first was steal from the best. We based American Birthright on the 2003 Massachusetts History and Curriculum Framework, and did extensive revisions from there. We did this because we wanted it to be a truly bipartisan framework. We want it to be acceptable to the Eagle Forum, and we want it to be acceptable to liberals in Massachusetts. And starting with the Massachusetts framework is a way of indicating this is a framework for all Americans. Now, we didn't just copy Massachusetts. We added a great deal of revisions to, frankly, to add even more substance, to simplify it, to make it simply be, here is something for kindergarten, and then each year, it's a model. It can be altered for each state and school district, but we wanted to present a very simple, thorough progression for an entire K-12 social studies curriculum.
All right.
We have a number of things we emphasized in our standards in distinction, I think, with many others. We have emphasis on patriotic content in the very early grade school years, kindergarten through third grade. That's terribly important. The educational mainstream has the idea that, you know, you start with community, you work up to state, eventually you get up to the nation, but at the last minute and hardly at all. The reason so many children have forgotten what it means to love America, have never learned it, is very much because of the standard social studies curriculum, which doesn't give stories of American heroes for kindergartners and first grades, which doesn't teach the national anthem or the flag, the symbols of the United States, E Pluribus Unum. You can teach this in an age-appropriate manner right from the very beginning. It's not difficult to tell a child at 4 or 5, you are an American, here's what you have in common with your fellow Americans, here is this glorious history you can share in. So that's very important. We have as well an emphasis on, in the middle schools, we've put this in particular, economics. We believe there should be not just economics instruction throughout the curriculum, although there also should be, but dedicated instruction in economics to learn the principles of the free market, the arguments about it, to simply learn that you cannot just choose, you know, get what you want without costs. You know, that this is a world with costs and benefits. And that you do need, I think, dedicated economics instruction as part of that. We put that in seventh grade. We would be delighted if that were altered to be in the high school, but you know, seventh grade seemed a reasonable place. We then have a dedicated eighth grade through 12th grade instruction. And this is where social studies should culminate. It starts with 2 years for the Western civilization sequence in the eighth and ninth grades. That's terribly important. Almost every state, I think perhaps all of them, have now abandoned teaching Western civilization and substituted a very vague and garbled world history course for that.
And I'm going to interrupt you for a minute. Can you?
Yes.
Why is that bad? What are what are the dangers of eliminating a Western civ class?
Social studies ought to teach our children the ideals and institutions of liberty. That doesn't start in 1776. It goes all the way back to the ideals of freedom and the institutions of freedom in ancient Israel, in ancient Greece, in ancient Rome, and then tracing all the way through medieval Christendom and early modern England, Parliament, common law, Magna Carta. everything that the founding fathers knew in 1776, the dangers of tyranny from the European past, and the successes of liberty, which they built upon as they crafted our republic. And you cannot know why the American Republic was built as it is without knowing all those ideals and institutions of liberty taught as a coherent historical narrative. That's why you need Western civilization. It's the precursor, is maybe putting it too weakly, but you have to know what happened in Western civilization to understand our freedom and our free republic. That's not an excuse not to study world history. And actually, I would say the modern world history courses tend to do a disservice to world history because they just tear topics which, in effect, are used to vilify Europe and vilify America. Here is another page from the history of imperialism. Look how bad they are. They don't actually respect the histories in themselves of China, of India, of the Middle East, of Africa or Latin America. So we also have a world history course which is focused on the non-European, non-American parts of world history, does them more rigorously, but also then integrates them with, indeed, the European empires, the integration of the world that happened under the auspices of Europe for several centuries.
Just for clarification, yeah. When you said you have a course, are you referring to the standards?
Yeah, the 10th grade standard. I just want to make sure
everybody knows, because it's like, I would love to take that course. But
a 10th grade standard. That's very important. But what we culminate with are standards for 11th grade United States history and 12th grade American civics. You know, the history of our country, the way our republic works. We wish to do an intensive history of America, which includes our liberty, our prosperity, our faith, our technological dynamism, the triumphs of our entrepreneurialism, and, you know, the various shortcomings we have had, you know, the terrible poverty of the Great Depression, the need for the Civil Rights Revolution to complete our dedication to liberty. All that as well, but all that as part of the story of common American liberty, the common American culture of our nation. So to learn about the importance of our first novelists, such as James Fenimore Cooper, to learn about America singing in Tin Pan Alley as you invent popular music and Broadway, in Hollywood, in film, Elvis Presley, Chuck Berry, everything that's made being American joyous for two centuries and more, that ought to be part of our history lessons as well. Then civics, detailed instruction of how our republic works, what ideals it's founded on, our constitutional history, you know, the history of the amendments, the Supreme Court cases that have brought us our liberty, the debates about liberty, the growth of the administrative state in the last century as a component of our government. All this to make students be able to understand, to argue, to be prepared to listen critically is the word of choice, but critically too often means parroting the opinions of your professors and your teachers in a sort of progressive catechism. Real critical thinking is thinking for yourself, including being able to criticize the opinions given to you by your professors in the guise of authority. And throughout, from eighth grade on, primary sources. That's terribly important. A textbook can lie by omission. A paraphrase by a teacher may not get the truth. You want and need our children to read the primary sources of history, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, or, for example, our primary sources that we suggest include a variety of sources on the Trail of Tears, the Cherokee chief John Ross's memorial, Andrew Jackson's message in favor of the removal of the five tribes, and Catherine Beecher at the time protesting against the Trail of Tears. You know, and that's terribly important to realize that Americans were terribly divided, that there was a moral critique of this from the very time. America has always been a land of debate and moral debate about every issue. It's not as if we discovered these issues suddenly and people were oblivious at the time. The only reason people now know and care about the Trail of Tears is because all Americans at the time were keenly aware of it as an issue, as an injustice. So this is to know the history of our own moral questioning throughout is part of what you get from having these primary sources. And I'll just say, for practicality, I do think it makes it much easier for teachers to be able to have the primary sources available. And with our primary source appendix, we have all the printed sources and online sources for any teacher, any school district, any parent to be able to go to the primary sources themselves.
Well, that's very, very helpful. And I also noticed going back to fifth grade, looking at one of the topics here on slavery, and walking through children, you know, the harsh conditions in the Middle Passage and slave life, and the responses of slaves to their conditions. So you certainly aren't ignoring the bad in America.
We don't believe so.
Yeah. Which so many today are accusing many of doing, but you're very forthright with the bad things that have happened. Do you want to mention anything about Black history or?
I will mention one of our primary sources is Jacob Lawrence's Great Migration series, which he painted in 1940. And that is telling the story of the African-American migration from the Jim Crow South up to, you know, the northern cities during the 19-teens, the 1920s, the 1930s. This is a document about, you know, the harsh conditions of Jim Crow, about the triumphs of Black Americans in their new northern homes. And most importantly, I would say, beauty. This is a work of American beautiful art that every American can look at and say, I'm proud that this is part of our cultural heritage. And they should know, our children, that when we talk about history, every part of it can include some talk of suffering, some talk of triumph. And perhaps what's the most noble and inspiring story of all, that you can turn stories of suffering and triumph into works of American beauty. And so I'm particularly happy about having Jacob Lawrence as part of our African-American history, along with Frederick Douglass, along with the story of African-American Christianity, the creation of the African Methodist Episcopal Church, slave preachers, gospel singing, Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois, yeah, everything.
Sounds fascinating. It certainly does. You and I recently had a conversation about equity related to knowing this information and having a rich content in your social studies lessons.
Yes, and this is important both as a good in and of itself and because it counters a popular but misguided critique. A great many educators argue in favor of lowered standards, lower rigor, less content in social studies standards, and indeed in social studies classes, on the grounds of equity, that somehow lowered standards are good for children who are deprived, underprivileged, that it's somehow unfair to expect more of them. And there's an extraordinary amount of research to show this is absolutely backwards. Lowered rigor hurts the underprivileged more because privileged children, however you define that, have greater access to the facts from their family and from their friends. They're going to learn all the facts they need anyway. But if you don't provide the content and the rigor in the schools, underprivileged children won't have the chance to learn it. Lowered standards, lowered rigor, and lowered content create a more unequal society, and in this language today, a more inequitable society. The argument for rigor is also an argument to bring the democratic promise of America to every child by means of our public schools.
Thank you. I agree. That's something very important for people to remember. Well, in wrapping this conversation up, let's talk about where people can find the information. So would you like to let them know your website?
Website is, well, where it's American Birthright at the Civics Alliance website. The precise HTTPS, civicsalliance.org, and then, slash American, I think, hyphen birthright, whatever the exact address. If you Google Civics Alliance and American Birthright, our webpage will pop up with our PDF, all our arguments and testimonials in favor of it, all the work to support it.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. I think the way I usually get there quickly is just Google American Birthright. It comes up. Certainly does. Well, and I would encourage any school district board members, any parents that are in Colorado that would like more information about American Birthright to contact me. And then I will help you all that I can. I can also put you in contact with Dr. Randall. The way to reach me is to go to the Independence Institute's website, independenceinstitute.org. You can go to thinkfreedom.org. That's an easy way. And you can find me there. If you can, if you want to jot down my email address, it's Pam, P-A-M, at I, that's the letter I, the number two, the letter I.org. So Pam at I2I.org. And I will see your email and we can have a conversation. So Dr. Randall, would you like to have any last words before we close out our conversation?
I think the most relevant thing I could say, and I do want to emphasize this for a Colorado audience, our standards can work well along with the Colorado standards. They can complement each other. They don't contradict one another. I think it will be easy for any school district to adopt the American Birthright standards and also fulfill all its obligations to the state of Colorado. And I guess I'd like to say that argument for practicality is important, in addition to the fact that we really think that American Birthright is good standards, transparent for parents, transparent for teachers, transparent for school board members. And the transparency makes them accountable to the people.
All right. Well, thank you so much. And I appreciate everyone listening. And please, please, please contact me with any further questions. Thank you, Dr. Randall.
Thank you.